Welcome back, long-suffering listeners, to a much delayed and frequently rescheduled and just like comedy of errors, riddles in the dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute and Signum University and the Tolkien Professor. We're sorry for the long delay and the sort of frequent sort of rescheduling and the uncertainty floating around this one. I think we like posted, okay, we're doing one tomorrow on Facebook, and then rescheduled it multiple times, and it's been like 3 months since the last episode.
Actually, when I put it up on Riddles in the Dark, I tell people it's like, until you see the Netmutant link, not absolutely confirmed.
Yeah. So if you showed up for one
of the... So I say we're thinking about it.
If you showed up for one of the aborted episodes, you only have yourself to blame. we're sorry about that. Life's just been chaos for all of us. Trish is busy with work. Corey's got like a zillion things going on, moves, work stuff. I'm in the middle of conference deadline submissions again in grad school. So hopefully this summer, I think this summer is going to be a little more sane for everybody. So I think this summer we'll be
able
to get on to
the latter half. Yes. Yeah. I now officially have, well, I shouldn't say officially because I haven't had closing day yet, but I officially have a new house. So that's what I was busy with last week, was firming that up. So that is now firm and
that's good.
Delightful. So yeah. So,
and actually our timing is really good because apparently I've been reading at least rumors, if not confirmed, that the new trailer is coming out with the man. It's going to be part of the Man of Steel showings. And then of course we have Comic-Con coming up in July, I think it is. So,
right.
You know, we're getting ourselves well positioned to be able to, deal with the flurry of information we'll be getting, hopefully.
Yeah. So, and I think Jordan Brown texted me an image of a teaser poster or something that we weren't sure if it's real or a fan made it, but it was like, what was the caption? It was something, it said Desolation of Smog, and it just had like a scenery shot, and then it was like, it couldn't come soon enough, or I don't know. I don't know if it was real or not, but Jordan was very excited.
Well, I've been trying to think, in the trailer, I don't know how much we'll see that's new to us. You know what I mean? Think about all the stuff we've already seen. We've seen the barrels. We've seen the Nazgul tombs. There's a bunch of stuff we've already seen.
Unless they show us a dragon or a necromancer or something. I don't think there'll be... they might develop some things, but we won't see anything that will just be like, whoa, didn't see that coming.
Right, exactly. I would expect some shots of Lake Town, which we haven't seen too much of. I mean,
that's true.
There was that preview thing that Jackson did recently, but other than that, there hasn't been much officially released as far as Lake Town stuff is concerned.
True that.
We have seen very little of Beorn.
We haven't really seen anything of Beorn. We've seen an axe, basically.
That could be like the main uncertainty, the main thing they could show us that we haven't really seen before. So that'll be interesting to see.
Some Mirkwood shots. You know, there are definitely things that they can do.
We'll see a lot of Tauriel, but we've already seen a bunch of Tauriel. So
yeah,
we're talking about things we want to see, Trish. Things we want to see.
You know, it's actually something that I'm gonna be kind of amused to watch is, you know, the kind of somewhere between trepidation and revulsion with which Tolkien fans are anticipating Tauriel and her character and her role in the films, it would just be I'd just be kind of interested to watch that kind of play out. I mean, I, you know, from the beginning have said about Tauriel, like, I totally understand why they're doing it. I mean, female roles are by and large a fine thing in a movie, and The Hobbit doesn't have any, so it didn't surprise me that they would invent a female character. Mm-hmm. And I have said from the very first time that was released, you know, if you ask me, if you have to invent a female character, that's a good choice, you know, to invent another elf. The elves are really underdeveloped in the book.
Yeah,
I mean,
we don't
know much about the wood elves. We never really get to know them other than the Elven King a little bit and that one brief glimpse two brief glimpses we get into elvish life being their glimpses of the woodland feasts and then the little, basically the stuff in the barrel hall, you know, the drinking bout between the butler and the guard, and then the barrel elves and their songs. That's all we get about elven, you know, about the elves and their society and everything else. So, you know, giving us some more elf characters and some more time with elves on screen makes sense, and we need a female character, and they could easily do a female character there without doing any violence to the rest of the story. I mean, they don't have to do something dumb, like let's put a female dwarf into the party, or they don't have to, you know, I mean, there's so many really horrible forced ways they could have done it.
They could have done it, that's true.
So,
well,
you know,
actually,
I mean,
and yeah. for me, there's two things with her. One is, for one of the, geez, you know, it all goes together, Corey. I think for the Story of the Hobbit course, I did my big paper was on the evolution of the Hobbit, you know, from oral story on through. And so part of my research was to learn about how has the Hobbit been adapted for stage and screen in the past, Rankin Bass at that point being the only one. But and I had a real fangirl of the book reaction when I was doing the research, because I was just horrified to how people had adapted this book, you know, killing the dragon at the mountain, you know, I mean, all, getting rid of Bjorn, getting rid of the wood elves. I mean, it's just horrible. So I'm a little bit more happy with Peter that he's actually, you know, adding characters rather than taking things away. But the other thing is that the Scott Holbrook Faust actually sort of slapped me on the wrist a little bit virtually today. You know, Laura and I posed a digest conundrum about, you know, and we probably need to shift it slightly. Brianna reminded me, but anyway, right now the way it stands is, will Tauriel have feelings, quote unquote, for Legolas? And Scott basically said, how sad, you know, basically that we have to, and it wasn't just to me, but it was generally, because, you know, the whole Keeley Tauriel thing's already come out. How sad, you know, how great that we added a female character, but how sad that we have to then sort of devolve it into, will there be romance just because there's a female character?
What other role could she possibly play, Scott?
Right. Though, I mean, you know, I mean, I appreciate Scott's question there. Really, the question, though, is just about the Hollywood percentages, though, right? I mean,
yes, right.
Like, what are the odds that a female character is added to an otherwise all-male cast and
no romance
enters in at any point? I mean, that seems a little unlikely, just given the Hollywood track record. But
plus, you figure the fanboys, you know, when they take their dates, there has to be something for the girls to appreciate, you know. And so that's how Hollywood thinks.
Seems to be the you know, the Hollywood framework, anyway.
Yeah. Yep.
But you know, Trish, getting back to your larger point, I really agree, and it's something I know that this is never going to be an argument that's going to really sway any Tolkien purists who hate the films, but my goodness, could it have been worse? You know, I mean,
oh God,
it's, I mean, there are so many things, and this is, I forget who it was who said this that I was talking to a while back, who said, you know, seriously, how many directors, like what percentage of directors, if they were going to undertake The Hobbit, would actually put all 13 dwarves on screen?
Yes.
I mean, you've got to know that the first thing that almost any director would do would be like, okay, this is what, how many? 8 dwarves too many, at least? You know, let's cut out the ones who never get a line and the ones about whom we know nothing, and let's just make this into a band of maybe 5 or 6. I mean, that's the obvious thing to do when you're turning this into a film. So just the mere fact that all of those things, which people are absolutely taking for granted, and which, you know, for the stuff for which purists give Jackson no credit, but I think he deserves a great deal of credit. I mean, there's – so anyway, I think that that's certainly
true. –
you know, Trish, as you say, giving examples from what other people have done. I mean, there are so many things that, like, just sort of coming from the kinds of complaints that people do about the choices that Peter Jackson has made. And it is like nothing. So anyway, backtracking to what I had been saying before about Tauriel, granted that they were going to introduce another woman, which seemed absolutely inescapable. I can scarcely think of a less intrusive way to do it than they have done. So, you know, I'm not gonna. I mean, heck, they could have made Radagast female, for crying out loud.
That's true. That's true.
And that still would have been less invasive than some other things they could have done, you know? I mean, look, let's have a female wizard figure. I could actually see that flying, you know, but I could definitely see that as an idea. Anyway, lots of things that
And, you
could
know,
happen.
Actually, by adding in Tariel, there's an outside chance that this might actually pass the Bechdel test. Are you familiar with that?
The What's
Bechdel
that?
Test. No,
I'm not. It's a. I can't remember who invented it. It was like a female movie reviewer. Oh, her name's Alison Bechdel. It was popularized.
That must be
there we go. It was popularized by. It was popularized by Alison Bechdel's comic Dykes to Watch Out For in a 1985 strip called The Rule. And the basically, it's this really simple three rule test that she made. To say whether a movie is sort of, you know, like has legitimate deep female characters, or whether it sort of can be considered kind of a woman friendly movie. And the three rules are: one, it has to have at least two named women in it; two, who talk to each other; three, about something besides a man. And you would be shocked.
Okay.
You would be shocked how many movies. In the history of cinema, you would be shocked by how few movies pass this. Like, there are just...
So there have to be two named female characters who talk... speak only to each other at least some point and talk about something other than men.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Now that's interesting.
Yeah. So by adding
Tariel... It could happen.
And...
I think it's unlikely.
Yeah. Having a conversation with the other female character seems unlikely. But if for some reason Galadriel,
that's gonna be the trick.
Hey, maybe they'll show up. Both show up at the Battle of Dol Guldur and talk some tactics, and then
that would count.
So anyway, maybe we should get on to today's topic.
Yes, we actually well, today's topic.
In fact, what I should do is first I should introduce us. So this is Riddles in the Dark, and I'm your co-host Dave Kale, and with me is Trish Lambert and the Tolkien professor Corey Olson. And despite that lengthy introduction, today's topic is actually not about Tauriel or other things like that. Today we're actually talking about the geopolitical sort of configuration of the northern world, which I realize probably sounds really, really like esoteric and complex, and why aren't we talking about whether this character will be on screen, that kind of stuff. But we kind of wanted to get out of the following along with the story in chronological order track we were on, especially because I think we're rapidly approaching the end of the second film, and we didn't want to go too far. But also, I think, in my opinion, I was the one that suggested this topic. I think this is some of the most interesting stuff about The Hobbit in general. Like, this is one of the areas where it connects to the larger Legendarium into the Lord of the Rings. This is one of the areas where it looks like Peter Jackson's sort of making some tweaks and changes and adding some things based on what we saw in the prologue. I think that was, in my opinion, that was one of the richest storylines in the first film. This sort of dwarven destiny of, like, let's go back and recapture our home and reestablish the kingdom. That it's not, you know, it's not like in the sort of the book where the dwarves are like, let's go get our gold from the dragon. But it's really more about reestablishing a dwarven homeland and that kind of stuff. So I think this stuff's super cool, and actually I expect most of Corey's listeners probably also will find it interesting, and it plugs a little bit into the whole Game of Thrones zeitgeist too, since that's a very political show. So I'm excited about this topic. I'm excited to hear what people have to say.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, I think this kind of thing is an important issue because it really gets at one of the fundamental factors that are involved in the process of this film adaptation, and which is one of the things that I think it's so important for Tolkien fans to kind of keep in mind, especially when people are just thinking about adaptation of the book, meaning adaptation of the published Hobbit. Because, of course, it's exactly this kind of thing that is the larger social cultural, you know, like world-building framework around the Hobbit story, that's exactly the stuff that Tolkien put so much thought into in the years after The Hobbit was published. The Hobbit is itself really sketchy, and I think that people so often don't take it for granted. They overlook this entirely because they are unconsciously projecting the Lord of the Rings back into The Hobbit. You know all of this stuff in the background. Like, for instance, you don't pay attention, perhaps, to how sketchy is the geography between the Shire and Rivendell, because having read Book One of the Fellowship of the Ring, you know very well the geography between the Shire and Rivendell, as it's later going to be. And so you kind of, perhaps unconsciously, project that into, you know, including, for instance, the exact location of the three stone trolls and everything else. So you know the geography retroactively. And so perhaps you don't notice when you are reading The Hobbit that The Hobbit itself, by itself, seems to know very little of any of that stuff. And this is also true in these bigger picture questions of the lands of Middle-earth and how these larger things are set up. These are things which were just not really fully developed at the time of The Hobbit, and he only developed later on. So when people talk about, you know, is it going to be true to the book? There's always been this question from the beginning, what exactly do you mean by that? True to the book in the sense that it's going to tell the story almost in a vacuum, which the book kind of does. Again, the vacuum is filled in very effectively, retroactively, later on. But the book itself contains very, very little about those background things that we tend to fill in from our Lord of the Rings experience. Jackson really doesn't have that option. By doing the Lord of the Rings films first and then doing The Hobbit, he has got to place the Hobbit story within the context that is established by the Lord of the Rings, as it, of course, was not when Tolkien wrote The Hobbit 17 years prior to publishing the Lord of the Rings. So these questions are things which have to be thought through by Jackson in ways that Tolkien did not think through them at the time of writing The Hobbit, but did think through them later on. So to me, the question of, is Jackson staying true to the book, is a much more complicated question than how close is the story he's telling to what we learn in the published Hobbit. Being true to what Tolkien wrote involves Tolkien's later thinking in The Lord of the Rings, in the appendices of The Lord of the Rings, in The Quest of Erebor, and in some of the other things that he, you know, thought about and the letters that he wrote, and even his mercifully aborted attempt in 1960 to rewrite The Hobbit in the style of The Lord of the Rings. So, you know, all of these things, when you take all of these things into account, that is, in my book, you know, what Tolkien wrote about The Hobbit. And so when I'm asking the question, is Jackson being true to what Tolkien wrote, that's what I'm kind of comparing to. Now, with the sort of the geopolitical issues, to me, one of the biggest questions, and there are a lot of things that we can talk about, and I think we should save for another episode the question of, like, the geopolitical situation of the bad guys, because that's a big question in itself, too. And we've touched on it some, what's going on with the Necromancer and what kind of operation is he really running in Dol Guldur and all that stuff. But the main thing we wanted to focus on here today is, what is the geopolitical situation around the Lonely Mountain? And let me kind of sketch in the issues, especially as they relate to the Lonely Mountain and the story as we get it in the published book. There is this. The question of the kingship under the mountain, of, you know, the dwarven king returning and becoming king under the mountain, seems to imply in the published Hobbit more than just the recovery of his, you know, halls beneath the Lonely Mountain, but of the reestablishment of a larger political order throughout that entire region. The actual political details of this are quite unclear to me. Was the situation as it is described in the book, is it conceived to be the king of the dwarves and Geryon of Dale and the elven king are all have no official political affiliation other than being neighbors and friendly to each other? Or is there a kind of overlordship implied in the depiction of the king under the mountain? And there is nothing that I can recall which explicitly suggests in the book that there was that kind of an official political rulership, that like the king of the dwarves had some kind of actual official suzerainty over the land roundabout. I don't see anything that actually suggests that. Girion was king in Dale. The word king is used. There's nothing said about him swearing fealty to the king under the mountain. And so there's no actual evidence that there was any kind of a feudal relationship between the king under the mountain and the king of Dale. But there is a general sense of the kingship under the mountain having far more of an impact on the region as a whole than simply the establishment of, you know, the dwarven kingdom and its armies. The fall of the kingdom of the dwarves was clearly the collapse of the entire region, and the restoration of the kingdom under the mountain will lead to the restoration of the entire kingdom. So at the very least, in a kind of mythic sense, the book does seem to me to suggest a kind of, you know, the king and the land are one, sort of, you know, as goes the kingship under the mountain, so goes the rest of the land. Even to the extent of having this, you know, the desert blight from the presence of the dragon marring the entire countryside round about, you know, that is kind of emanating out from the mountain in some kind of sense, seems to me like the opposite of what we see later on with the cleansing and the prosperity which comes, because surely the prosperity that comes from the mountain is much more is much more complicated, as well as much less tangible than simply rivers of gold flowing out of the mountain, as is suggested by the people of Lake Town. So that's one factor that I think. Another thing is the way in which on at least two occasions, people are talking to Thorin about his duties as king, and are primarily concerned with his relationship with the humans and the elves. And here I'm thinking of Roach and Gandalf. Roach, who says that he would like to see the kingdom established, reestablished as it was of old, by which he seems to mean in amicable partnership with their human allies. That for Roach, the king, you know, the heir, the long-lost heir of the dwarves returning and reestablishing himself as king, that's not going to be, in Roach's eyes, the actual restoration of what was before if he comes back and is at war with the human enemies. There's a way in which that that kingship will remain unfulfilled, unrealized, if that were to happen. The other is Gandalf's rebuke of Thorin at the gate, you know, in the Descendant of Rats scene, when Gandalf says that he's not making a very fine figure as king under the mountain. And clearly what he is criticizing is his treatment of both his followers, in the person of Bilbo in that case, and also of those who should be his friends and allies. Thorin is not acting like a king, and how a king would be acting is not just thinking about his own wealth and his own vengeance and his own rights, but thinking about distributing wealth and thinking about being a blessing to those around him rather than taking what is owed to him and refusing to give anything more, which seems to be the way in which Thorin is thinking. Again, those are sort of vague references. Again, there's no reference to any kind of actual overlordship in place. But I certainly am left with a very strong impression that the kingship under the mountain is the keystone of the entire region politically, and that even if Girion of Dale didn't actually get down on one knee and swear fealty before the king of the dwarves, nevertheless, he was in a sense a kind of client king of the kingdom under the mountain, and that the restoration of the land Broadly understood, it's not just about, like, let's get rid of Smaug and rebuild the halls under the mountain. The whole blessing of the land comes from having the king back, and the entire region is prospered, not just through directly through the treasure, but more intangibly, more mythically, through the return of the proper king. So, I mean, in my book, I was making sort of jokes about the fact that there is a way in which what we're getting in The Hobbit, in chapter 10 and forward, is a Return of the King story. And that there actually are, if you look at it, there actually are parallels between Thorin in his return and Aragorn in his return to Gondor. And so that kind of element, and thinking about the way what the return of the king to Gondor means to all of the other parties, or, you know, to Rohan, what it means, you know, even thinking about Faramir as a kind of, as a sort of semi-independent figure, you know, what it means to Dol Amroth, you know, to Prince Imrahil. You know, again, it's not explicitly the same relationship. You know, with Gondor, we do get an explicit overlordship relationship between them and the Rohirrim and all the others, but obviously to Faramir. But again, it strikes me that there are quite a lot of parallels to the way that that is presented, though it's presented less forcefully in The Hobbit, obviously, than in The Return of the King.
Corey,
so we do get that sense of it. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, what is the political arrangement, or do we know the political arrangement following the Battle of Five Armies, when Dain becomes king under the mountain and Bard restores the kingdom of Dale, leading up to the time of the War of the Ring? Do we have sort of the vassal relationship between Dale or King under the Mountain, or I mean, it sounds interesting. You get hints of that when they're talking about at the Council of Elrond, and then even in Gandalf's description of the battles up by the Lonely Mountain, but not quite, because when they're talking about the emissaries from Sauron, you know, pushing them for news of Bilbo, you get the, you know, there's this line where Glowin says that that Dain's worried that I guess it's King Brand at that time. Might yield. And so you have the sense that the dwarves, it's not like the dwarves can tell them, it's not like they're vassals where the dwarves can tell them, keep your mouths shut, don't say anything. You know, the men of Dale have some agency there. And then also we get this, you know, sort of emotional description of Dain standing over the body of King Bran wielding his axe. So that's pretty an interesting idea of the dwarf king sort of defending the putting his life on the line to defend the king of Dale. So what is the sort of the political situation afterward? Is it a vassal relationship, or is it more?
Well, again, we're not told explicitly. You know, so much is made, of course, of the oath of, you know, Aerol the Young and Kieran the Steward. You know, so the oath of Aerol is such a central piece in the political situation in Rohan and its relationship with Gondor, and we don't get anything like that. There's no reference to that kind of thing, and I'm pointing to that because that's, of course, the clearest example of the kind of thing we're talking about, where on the one hand, Rohan remains an autonomous kingdom, but it clearly is, it has more than just an allegiance with Gondor. They're independent. You know, Théoden is not, well, Théoden is a bad example. Éomer is not a vassal of Aragorn's, exactly. They swear an oath of mutual friendship with each other. You know, I think of the cry, and I always sort of laugh about this, and usually shout out the completion of the line that they left out of the film, when Théoden is saying, you know, is urging his people to charge into battle for Lord and land, and then he stops in the film. But of course, in the book, he continues, and League of Friendship. Because, of course, it's that last that they're really fighting for. They're fighting kind of for their land, in that if Minas Tirith falls, their land will presumably be next eventually. So they are kind of fighting for their land, and they're certainly fighting for their lord who has summoned them, but the whole point of why their lord has summoned them is to stay true to their League of Friendship, to stay true to the people that they have sworn to support and to help. And that seems to be a League of Friendship seems to be what exists between the Lonely Mountain and Dale in that period that you're describing. I think of another line from Glóin there in his, not in the council, but in his conversation with Bilbo, or with Frodo rather, at the feast, right before the council, when he says that nowhere are there any men that are more friendly to us than the men of Dale. And the way that he talks about it there definitely implies to me that they are not vassals. He certainly doesn't seem to look at them as vassals. You know, he doesn't say like, ah, yes, like our people in Dale, they're awesome, right? That's not his, that's not his tack there. Instead, you know, he says, they're our friends. And it's that, it's that element of friendship and the close friendship, both sort of personal and political, which I think that we can see in that image that you were describing of, you know, of old King Dan standing over the body of Brand in the battle up there. So I do think
Do you think that gives us a hint at all about the way things might be, if they delve into this into the film at all? Do you think this gives us some kind of hint about maybe how Peter Jackson might portray things?
Well, see, here's the thing. It seems to me that Jackson in the first film has already made the move to simplify these matters by mm-hmm. making an explicit political tie. And I do think that the explicit swearing of fealty to the dwarves does simplify matters rather than just saying, hey, aren't we all kind of getting along? Because again, to me, there's more than just, you know, again, like when Gandalf rebukes Thorin and says that he's not making a very fine figure as king, there's more here than just, boy, you're really screwing up in the foreign, you know, foreign affairs department, Thorin. You're really making a hash out of your local allegiances here, which he is, but there's more to it than that. You know, that there is a way in which connected to the mythic idea of being king, and even more to the mythic idea of restoring the kingship and restoring order to the region through his return.
He's
completely failing at that. Yeah, Trish, go ahead.
This is where I will jump in, actually, because I wanted to say, Kay Ben Avraham asked a question kind of along this line. I've been trying to find a good spot to have you talk about this. She asks, where was Tolkien drawing from for his concept of good kingship? Sorry about Buddha in the background. I hear echoes of Old Testament, but I'm curious about Anglo-Saxon or Norse ideas with which I'm not so familiar. I know you've talked about this before, but would you kind of give us that synopsis again?
Yeah, this is tricky because, you know, it's one of the things that's really kind of funny and hard to place. I was actually just having a conversation about this with an old friend of mine who is a political science professor and a Tolkien fan, and saying about basically how he gets really uncomfortable with Tolkien in these ways, because Tolkien will, on the one hand, look like, you know, a very, you know, what my political scientist colleague would call, you know, friend and colleague would call, you know, unenlightened, you know, political thinker. So, you know, who, like, when you look at the Shire and its elected officials and its, you know, its aversion to any kind of, you know, sort of strong arm political power seems to be one model of political thinking. But then you've got the whole Return of the King stuff and the focus on kingship as a positive thing in other places that then seems to go against that. And so he was like, you know, where is Tolkien here, and how do we reconcile the Shire as an ideal with Gondor as an ideal? You know, is he pro monarch? Basically, is he a monarchist or is he not a monarchist? And you know, and it's a really good question, because of course it's not just the question, it's not just about Gondor. Certainly you go back through the Silmarillion tradition and, you know, you've got nothing but kings. You know, all the old, you know, we don't have elected officials among the elves in the First Age. You know, you've got hereditary lordships all over the place. That does seem to be the model that he generally uses. The Shire is the one that's deviant, not kings. as far as Tolkien's world seems to be concerned. But
I'm going to go out on a limb and
time,
guess that we're probably
yeah,
not supposed to infer anything from this.
Yeah, well, from what, from his representation of kingship?
Yeah, or rather that his statement about kingship is not, he's not stating a preference for monarchies over democracies, but rather he's talking more about abstract principles. So like it's you know that so the kinds of things that he admires in the ideal king that he presents in the books are things that he would admire in the ideal elected official or the ideal civil servant or the, you know, anything like that, that
right.
It's really more about
right.
the abstract principles than it is about the specific form in which it appears.
Right. No, I agree. And that's usually where something like what I usually come down on in a discussion like that is to say that Tolkien clearly really liked the, like the mythic force of the idea of the king. And kingship as a mythic concept is obviously one that he finds very important. And certainly the return of the king makes for a better story and a more mythically powerful story than the story of a kingship which is in turmoil but then manages to elect a really forward-thinking official who sets the government to rights again. That just doesn't have the same mythic power as the return of the king that we get in The Lord of the Rings. So
the return of the fair and free elections.
Exactly. I mean,
it doesn't have the same ring.
No, it really doesn't. It really
well,
doesn't.
Also, doesn't his position as a medievalist kind of enter into this? I mean, isn't that a? I always thought it was kind of that, you know, the mythic, but also sort of the medieval government model. I always thought kind of was had an influence.
To some extent, yeah. Though I mean, it's you know, Tolkien's kings are not necessarily very much like medieval kings. I mean, going back to Kay's particular question about, you know, Anglo-Saxon or Norse ideas, certainly there are Anglo-Saxon ideas of the kings, and obviously you don't have to go any further than Rohan to see a very Anglo-Saxon-ish king indeed. But more, I guess, I would say to Kay, the general principles of that do seem to inform Tolkien's principles of kingship very much. And by the general principles of that, what I mean is one of the things which Tolkien clearly valued most about the concept of the king as it's depicted in Anglo-Saxon, in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, is the kind of reciprocal relationship, the bond between the king and his followers. And here the most, by far the most evocative example of this that I can think of in the Anglo-Saxon tradition is in The Wanderer. This is a very famous example, but again, I find it very powerful. The poem The Wanderer is an elegy. It's a poem that is spoken by the survivor of a kingdom that has fallen. His king and the other warriors in his little kingdom have all been destroyed. Their hall was burned down, and he's now out wandering the world on his own, cold and lonely, and not sure what to do. And when he thinks back to his king, he speaks very emotionally about his king, and what he recalls. You know, there's this passage which, modern students, when we do this in Anglo-Saxon class, always find this passage, for good reason, very striking. His memories of his lord involve him sitting at the feet of his lord with his head resting in his lord's lap. And like the affection with which he speaks of his lord, it's like he has this mental image of himself cuddling his king. This is not just like a theoretical ideal. This is not just, but that kind of personal bond of like that he, him as the king, as the father figure of his people. We can see the way in which he evokes this, especially with Théoden in The Lord of the Rings. The example that always makes me think of this most is when he meets when Théoden is marching out, and he meets Kaorl, the rider who comes to give him news. And, you know, Kaorl comes with notched sword and says, "Is Amir here? You've come too late." And then Théoden steps forward and names the guy by name. He recognizes him and names him by name and says that he's here. And, you know, Kaorl just drops to his knees and says, "Command me, Lord." And immediately his tidings, which he was bringing to say, you know, "There is no hope. You're too late. We can't do anything." Now that the king himself has come, now he's, you know, he you know, takes out his notched sword and lays it at his king's feet, and he's ready to go back and fight now because the king himself has come. That's that sort of spirit of the Anglo-Saxon king, and more importantly, of the bond between sort of what that idea of the king and kingship means to those warriors, means to the people, and the kind of relationship that the king has with the people. Now, that same motto isn't true everywhere. I mean, you know, the kings of Gondor don't seem to be very much like the Anglo-Saxon kings in those ways as far as their relationship with their subjects is concerned. It's a little hard to imagine anybody coming up and, like, kneeling next to the great throne in Minas Tirith and resting his head on the lap of the king of Gondor, but it's still a that idea of the mutual... the relationship of mutual love between king and subject is a real. A lot of those elements I think really do inform this idea of kingship. And Dave, as you were saying, I agree with what you said that I don't think the depictions of kings and of kingship in Tolkien really amount at the end of the day to a political preference that you can say. See, this shows that he's a monarchist in his political leanings, or like sort of that's what he supports politically. No, I don't think so at all. In practice, you know, when you've got an actual, you know, human being sitting on an actual throne ruling an actual people, you know, in the modern day world, Tolkien seemed to have been as uncomfortable with some of those things as anybody else. But again, as a mythic idea, as a framework in which to have stories take place. That's the kind. It's this idea of kingship that he wants to have his stories engaged with, not to. You know, we don't have the overcoming of evil. You know, despite the you know the rhetoric of recent American presidents to the contrary, the conquest of evil and spreading of good in Middle Earth does not correlate to the spreading of democracy. That's just not the system that, you know, sort of the mythic system that Tolkien is advocating, really.
Right.
But so thinking back to the interrelationships there. So again, it's I keep thinking larger mythic terms. Yep. Yeah. Go.
Sorry, this is another thing I wanted to ask you. But again, you know, we've been talking about Geryon and the line of Geryon and allegiances and whatnot, but in terms of Jackson's movie, did he actually, I mean, he specifically talks about Thranduil, but did they actually mention Geryon in the exposition at the beginning?
No. Did they? I didn't see Geryon.
I don't think so.
I've seen Geryon.
I mean, there's obviously no call out like there is with Thranduil walking into the hall and doing his head nod thing. I mean, all they really show is just Dale, so it's almost... We almost get the impression, don't we, in the movie, that it's almost kind of like the dwarves either oversee Dale or it's—I don't know. I mean, it's
Dale
not
like
really
a suburb,
very clear.
Basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's not really clear. A suburb.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just because it just dawned on me when we were talking about Geryon that, you know, we're assuming Geryon's name's even going to come up in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine it's not going to when we
I know.
When we get to Bard, but just again, just thinking of the power of, you know, the return of the long lost heir of the king. You know, I mean, that's such a powerful and traditional story element. It's a little hard to imagine that.
Well, it is kind of a trope.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Sort of the Strider thing. Yeah, and you know, the heir to the throne, you know, who's not in power kind of thing. Because the only other option then Jackson would have is just simply Bard becomes the leader in Dale due to his prowess at, you know, killing the dragon, which is not that big of a, I mean, that's not really a movie trope.
Right, right. Though, I mean, again, it could, I could imagine a movie ending in which basically Bard just takes over as master, you know, is not necessarily named king, but basically takes over the master of Lake Town's position.
Oh, true. Masters. Yeah, right.
So that he's clearly in a position of leadership among his people, but yet not appointed king in a way that's going to kind of conflict or lead to any...
if the master is portrayed as an elected official in the movie, then Bard could simply be elected unanimously to be the new master, right?
Exactly. And then even if he rebuilds Dale, that doesn't necessarily mean that now his position is different. You know, again, he could still be the acclaimed leader of his people without ever being called a king.
And no hereditary issue on that.
Conceivably. Conceivably. Yeah. Again, it's a little hard for me to imagine.
That's the toughie. I mean, so hard, and it's hard to predict. Yeah. Because, I mean, Jackson's held pretty true to the book in areas where it hasn't, you know, he hasn't had to diverge, so it's. I would prefer to think he'd stick with it here too.
Yeah. What do you think, Dave? Do you think we're going to get Geryon?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
But it's true. It's something we've been kind of taking.
When
for
you
granted.
Say get, do you think when you do you mean see him or will
no,
someone mention
him? I just mean any reference to him. That the
Thorin
the,
will be
the
like,
Geryon
oh yeah,
concept.
I remember your. I remember Geryon.
Right. Right. Well, of course, that is another issue, is that we have to address the compressed time frame thing. Because, I mean, it has been only 60 years. So whereas it's a much wider gap, it's over 150 years in the book. So you have several generations, of humans between the fall of Dale, and the return of Thorin to Lake Town, with only 60 years passing, you're going to have, and I know we talked about this some when we talked about Bard, but you're going to have, you know, a fair number of people, such as presumably the girl whose doll catches fire, still alive at the time of the films. So, and at the least, you're talking about, I mean, he would be what, the grandson at most? As far as the most distant remove that Bard could be from Geryon would be grandson.
Yep.
In which case, if you've got his grandfather Geryon, then you've got an inescapable kind of Thorin Geryon Bard parallel with, like, my grandfather the old king issue going on there. And maybe they would avoid that so as to limit the number of, like, former king grandfathers we have floating around in this plot. I could see that as an argument. But Trish, you're right. I think I had not been thinking enough about the conspicuous absence of any reference to any kind of autonomous political situation in Dale there in that prologue.
Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean it's not there, because it could be that Jackson elected not to bring it up in that prologue. And
or
it will be brought
from the cinematic version.
Yeah.
And it'll be brought up in the second movie when we get to Lake Town, and we get the and then we'll have exposition about it at that point. Right. So it doesn't mean he's not in it. I just was interested. It was just interesting that he hasn't introduced Geryon or any kind of government, Dale kind of government at all.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, I wonder if we will, in one of the next couple of films, get a Bard flashback.
It's quite possible, because it would make a kind of sense, if we have Peter Jackson having made a decision to omit any reference to the politics of Dale and its relationship to the Mountain, that could be done simply out of efficiency. The question, you know, Thranduil is brought into the prologue because the scene, it's necessary, though we don't get to Mirkwood in film one. Thorin's elf issue needs an explanation. you know, the significance of Thranduil's non-support when Smaug came and attacked. You know, this the significance of that needs to be explained, which because, of course, even though Thranduil's not a character, it comes up again and again in Thorin's animosity towards elves all the way through the first movie. So that bit is necessary. The Dale stuff, totally not necessary for the first film. So yeah, maybe he's saving it, and we're going to get a separate flashback, a you know, maybe even a very similar, like, here's what that night and the years that followed looked like from the human point of view, rather than from the dwarven point of view that we get in the first flashback.
That would make sense, because this one is going to be much more human. This is going to be a human-oriented installment, you know, where we didn't have any humans at all, really, in the first movie.
Correct, yeah.
So, yeah, I could see him doing that.
Yeah, I could see them doing that. I mean, it's hard to see them going over too much ground again. I could also see that there was something in it that was cut out for the cinematic edition, or possibly cut out when they expanded from two films to three films. But I don't know. The more I think about it, the more likely it begins to sound to me that they could remove the kingship from Dale just to avoid confusion, so that you don't have to, so that they don't even have to answer that question, how are the people there related to Erebor? Because as I recall, thinking back to the description of Dale and the kites and everything, and then the way that we get that sort of pan over to the gates of Erebor with Bilbo's voiceover saying, you know, like one of the mightiest kingdoms, you know, for next to them stood one of the mightiest kingdoms of Middle-earth, you know, Erebor. And it does, that thinking about how they did that does make it sound to me like they're just leading us to understand that Dale is not any kind of autonomous kingship, but like a settlement of humans that happens to be right next to Erebor.
It did kind of, you know,
right.
It did seem like if you only knew what you knew from the film and you had to guess, that's what you would guess.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yeah, that's just how I'm thinking of it. Right. Now, but at the same time, presumably they would have some kind of local leadership. Right. I mean, even if they are just existing as a kind of suburb of Erebor, it's not like they're going to take their every, you know, court case and property dispute to the king of Erebor. So they're going to have a local leader of some kind, and maybe that could be the position that the master fulfills. See, to me, this is one of the questions, and this is one of the things that we were kind of wrestling with when we were thinking about a riddle for this episode. To me, one of the interesting questions is going to be, how is the culture of Lake Town depicted in the film? And what I mean by that, or the particular aspect of that, I mean, is how present is the story of the days of old going to be in the lives of the people of Lake Town? That is, are they going to see their current structure, their current lifestyle there at Lake Town, the political regime of the master of Lake Town, are they going to see that as the norm? Are they going to see that as, yes, this is how we have always done things in Lake Town? Or are they going, you know, and then on top of that, there are also some distant legends about, like, when there used to be a king under the mountain and things were different, but nobody really remembers that and nobody really cares. Or is there going to be a more present sense of the way things were of old, and a recognition on the part of the characters in the film that the political regime of the master of Lake Town is essentially a newfangled thing, which is not part of the way things have always been done at Dale, and that you have people pining for a return to their old political structure or their old leadership, approach, or however else things used to be different. Like, how are they going to view the master and their current lives as the status quo? That is how it is in the book. You know, the master of Lake Town says, we have, you know, we in Lake Town, we have always elected our leaders from among the old and wise, and we have never endured, you know, the leadership of mere fighting men. So he says this is how it's always been done in Lake Town, though he does suggest things were different in Dale, and there was a king in Dale. Which, of course, even further complicates things, right? So that the king of Dale is not even just king of the humans roundabout, but apparently king of that city and its lands alone, which makes it even a smaller kingdom than it looked like being. But anyhow, so how is Lake Town, how is Jackson going to do it? I think it'll have a huge impact on how Bard is depicted, and I know we've talked about this in a previous episode, but if... basically, the climate of Lake Town is, well, nowadays, like, things are different, and, like, this is a much shabbier operation, and we've got this master, but, like, you know, wouldn't it be awesome to get back to the good old days of Dale, and then they all embrace Bard when he emerges? Or is the king merely a distant and legendary idea that gets invoked and sort of catches fire with them over the course of the story? Those two things, I think, create very different situations in Lake Town, and also then, of course, open up very different questions about the relationship between Lake Town and the Lonely Mountain. What do you think about that, Dave? Do you, which do you think... there, as far as the relationship between the people of the lake and the master of Lake Town, is it your sense that he's going to play? Do you think he's going to play the master of Lake Town, or rather, like, the mastership of Lake Town? Forget, like, what kind of a guy the master of Lake Town is.
But you mean the role?
The role that he has, the regime that is in place in. Is sort of the structure that's in place in Lake Town.
That's an interesting. That's a really tough question, because obviously we were talking about this before when we were trying to come up with a riddle. There's this idea that, like, you know, the people in the book don't seem to have their memory of the good old day. You know, sort of the time before when, you know, the time before the dragon, when Erebor was around. It has sort of faded into myth, and that there aren't people really. Yes. They didn't maintain a accurate, you know, record of the way of the history of Dale and the region dating back to the time of the King Under the Mountain. That they, you know, that the things that they say about the return of the King of the Under the Mountain is that the rivers will flow with gold and all this kind of stuff. Which, I mean, maybe you could say that that's a metaphor, and what they're really talking about is, like, hey, without the dragon, we could really get some commerce going and somebody finally get back to work mining that mine. But it doesn't sound like that. And it doesn't sound like they really take it seriously either. Well, I guess they kind of—it's hard to interpret in the book. You know, obviously they are really excited about the dwarves, but it's not clear whether they really believe that they'll succeed or anything. It gives you the sense of sort of a, almost like a sort of a religious or mythical belief, as opposed to, like, an actual sort of, you know, knowledge of history and conviction that things will come about.
They like the idea of the king.
Yeah.
But it's not that they're saying, ah, we believe in Thorin and we believe he will succeed. That's the difference between the people of the town in general and the master in the book. Is the master seems to be the only one of them actually thinking in practical terms.
Right.
And he doesn't really believe that Thorin, his personal belief is that Thorin is a fraud and is just conning everybody. And so he is pushing them along because he's hoping to expose them that you know, Thorin is never going to actually go and try to attack the dragon.
Right.
But of course that turns out to be not true. So yeah, the master is the only one who's thinking in those kinds of practical terms. I agree. There is a much more sort of mythic / religious sense in the people. Like, they love the idea of the king, but they're not thinking in any kind of practical terms.
Right. But I don't know how well that'll work in the film. Like, I feel like in the film there'll be more of a tendency to maybe try to make the people more proactive instead of the people just having resigned themselves to living on these wooden shanties on the edge of the lake, and just, you know, like, well, we got to put up with old money bags and the other money bags because that's just the way things are. Like, I sort of, like, I'm tempted to think that they will go in the direction of trying to make the people more proactive, that there'll be people who either have a living memory of what things were like, or at least have been, you know, like, maybe Bard, some guy who's been obsessed with his, you know, grandmother's tales of the olden days, and he's like, wants to reestablish his kingship or something like that. And so I wonder if there'll be a greater, you know, there'll be like an opposition party in the town fighting against they've kind of hinted at that with Bard already, that he's going to be like some kind of rebel on the run from the authorities. So I wonder if they're going to take that and run with it.
Exactly. And the logical extension, talk about running with it, the logical extension of that idea is then to make the master of Lake Town a usurping tyrant.
Yes.
You know, a kind of, a kind of like Sheriff of Nottingham figure or whatever. That would be the logical extreme, to have his rule be imposed upon the people either by force or at least as an innovation with which they're not entirely comfortable,
right,
and to have Bard be the lead person of the significant faction of the people of Lake Town who really long for a return to the way things were.
Right.
And that the master of Lake Town is seen as an offshoot of the unfortunate and unhappy circumstances of the present.
The one thing about that is,
but you know, you mentioned. Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say the casting of Stephen Fry. I wonder if we should take that into account. Like, is he the kind of guy you would have play that role, or is he gonna be more of a buffoon? I mean, I guess he could do it.
He could do. I mean, he doesn't have to be. He doesn't have to play, you know, a complete straight man, totally wicked and malicious kind of Sheriff of Nottingham figure.
Right.
I mean, that I wouldn't think would be necessary. He could be, I would expect him to be cunning. That's one of the things which is the sort of central to the idea of the Master of Lake Town in the book, is that he is very cunning and very calculating.
I think Stephen Fry actually said in an interview, I was going to say cowardly. You know, he's a despot, or I mean, he could be a despot, and you know, like you said, cunning and calculating, but basically cowardly, which would drive a lot of his behavior. You know, hiding behind the military, or blustering and being very authoritative, and you know, that kind of thing. But I remember Fry saying, I think he did say in an interview that he's a coward.
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly physically a coward. That when it comes to actual battle danger, that he runs for it and saves his own hide rather than doing anything self-sacrificial or brave.
But, and he's much more covert in his activities and very castle intrigue as opposed to being, you know, like directly confrontational.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. But that's not to say, but I mean, I think that you're right, that kind of cowardliness can very easily manifest itself as despotism. You know, is very much... congruent with despotism. And it could be that particular kind of despotism where he is seeking to exert through his, either through his wealth or through his soldiers or both, to assert this kind of control over Lake Town and over the people, and that Bard's return to Bard's ascension to power would be seen as one way or another a kind of restoration of the traditional order.
But I do wonder, back to your point, back to your point, you know, how you said we don't want too many grandsons, you know, looking for the throne, littering the landscape. In a similar vein, would Jackson really want to evoke the return of the king theme? Because it sure seems like if they went that direction, it would. Seems so similar to Aragorn's story.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is similar. I mean, there are parallels. There are parallels between Bard and Aragorn. There are parallels between Thorin and Aragorn. And that's okay. But I wouldn't think that Peter Jackson would have to distance himself from those parallels too much, because so much is different in the circumstances that even if there are kind of big picture parallels between the situations, neither the characters nor the circumstances are really going to look that much like Aragorn's situation that people are necessarily going to be sitting there saying, what are we watching the same movie again? How did this happen?
Right. Actually, I could see it as an advantage because it's almost subliminally makes the connection as opposed to being overt about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And then on the other hand, you know, I could see him going the other way, which is to literally, like we talked about earlier, making Bard more the elect, you know, oh, let's elect Bard now. You know, we got rid of this master that we shouldn't right. elect. Let's elect Bard now. And there's not even a whiff of lost kingship in it. So this is right. going to be interesting to see how he does that, actually.
Yeah,
I know.
Of course.
I know Jackson said they took pains to make Bard an enigmatic character in the second film, but that's a direct quote from him. So I'm not sure right. exactly what that means, but
right, or whether we'll just not learn the answer to yeah,
right.
questions in film two.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, of course, one thing that I've been kind of combining here is this idea of the desire to return to the glory of the past and the kingship of Girion, but of course one could do one without the other. There didn't have to be a king in Dale. Girion, you know, whoever it is, you know, whether his name is Girion or not, who is Bard's, you know, forerunner, who you know, whose ways Bard is wanting to return things, doesn't have to have been king. So they could have that kind of idea of the master being a deviation from the way things had always been done and should be done in Lake Town, and of Bard in the end being the champion of the restoration of that old order without kingship being in the picture there. That's certainly possible. So basically we could get no Girion and still have that idea of the return to the traditional good old days.
Right. A slightly different topic. Do you think that Dian and that group of dwarves will be sort of referred to, introduced in film two, and will they have some kind of connection, either political or economic, to the Lake Town folks?
That's an excellent question. Especially the latter part was one I hadn't thought of at all. Do I think we'll get some reference to Dian? Yes, I do. I do think that so that we'll be ready for him when he shows up, presumably in film three. However, will there be any kind of connection, any kind of relationship, any kind of recognition between the dwarves of the Iron Hills and the men of Lake Town in their current stance? That is, like when Dan shows up, is the master of Lake Town or Bard or somebody in Lake Town going to be like, oh, great, them? You know, like, are they going to recognize them, basically? And I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I feel like I have no idea how to guess this ever since. I mean, I still haven't recovered from watching The Fellowship of the Ring and the, like, shock to my system that I got when I discovered that Boromir had heard of Aragorn. You know, that connection, when in the Council of Elrond, Aragorn is mentioned and Boromir says, Aragorn? I'll never forget watching that film in the theater for the first time and being like, what just happened there? Why has Boromir heard of Aragorn and what on earth is happening? That was to me so strange. So who knows? Anything is possible. My guess would be no. That we're not going to get any kind of recognition of Dan, that we're not going to get any back history between the dwarves of the Iron Hills and these others, because it creates one more plot line to you know, one more story that has to be told in order to set up the story that's happening. And I would think that they would just be kind of role, you know, be Dan and the other dwarves would be operating, as far as the humans and elves are concerned, as
independently,
just kind of under
yeah.
the Erebor umbrella, really.
I mean, I could see the master maybe saying something like, we already have enough dwarves in this part of the world. We don't need more.
Exactly. Or we're better off without them. You know, it's been kind of nice with no dwarves, actually.
The only good dwarf is a dead dwarf.
Right. That would be the next next level of that expression.
But now Thorin will be fully aware, of course, that Dian is there. And I mean, obviously, to me, obviously, you know, because in the book he calls on him for aid. And I mean, right? I mean, doesn't he send Roak, or does Roak volunteer to go? I can't remember which.
No, he does. He sends
him. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, exactly. And in the film, of course, Thorin starts off by going to his kin and seeking allies.
Right.
Them refusing to come, and that seems to be a setup for the fact that he is going to have a kinsman and ally who is going to come when he calls, and that's Dan at the end. So, so I do assume that that's what's going to happen. I do assume that Thorin is going to summon Dan, and he's going to come in response, as a sort of a corresponding moment to the failure at the beginning of the first film, his failure to rally allies.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to give you guys advance notice that the Michael, this is definitely a Michael Lucero episode today. He's done amazing things. I would like to end with Tauriel as we began with Tauriel, which means we have to go through the riddle first, because I don't want to mess her up, because he shared a link on your Facebook page that actually pertains to some of the stuff we were talking about at the beginning. So, but I just want to give you a warning. We'll do that later. So okay. I'm thinking we should probably segue into the riddle fairly soon.
Yeah. Well, the riddle, and especially since the riddle is addressing the relationship between the lake and the elves, which is sort of the other leg of this tripod that we haven't really talked about too much, other than to recognize the fact that the film one did establish an explicit relationship of vassalage between the Elven King and the Dwarven Kingdom of Erebor, which therefore, of course, leads me not to wonder whether or not the human cities, you know, the human lands near the mountain were autonomous. They certainly, if the Elven King isn't autonomous, Dale and Esgaroth were certainly not autonomous from Erebor back in the day. The only question is whether they even have a king at all, to come and swear fealty in that same way. But then there's the question of what will the relationship between the Elven King and the lake be like? You know, not how they're connected with the dwarves, but how they're connected with each other, and how Tolkien is going to depict that. It's one of the things, we know how Tolkien depicted it, how Jackson is going to depict it. How Tolkien depicted it is, of course, one of the interesting elements of the whole thing. Tolkien shows us the complicated political situation in which the master of Lake Town finds himself upon the arrival of Thorin and company, because he doesn't want to offend the Elven King, because the Elven King was very strong in those parts. He knows, and if these people are escaped prisoners of the Elven King, if he is sheltering and encouraging escaped prisoners from the Elven King's dungeon, that's a pretty serious political step to be taking. He would have, you know, a duty, or at least it would be very much in his best interest, to recapture the dwarves and hand them back over to the elves. That's what a good ally should do when somebody comes to your hall and says, oh yeah, I just broke out of the prison of your close friend and ally. What you're supposed to do is recapture them and return them. So he knows that he should do that, but at the same time, he is under this burden of humoring the public acclaim that the dwarves are meeting in Lake Town. So he can't offend the people by throwing the destined returning king under the mountain that they're all singing songs about. He can't clap him in irons and send him back up the river. So he waits and tries to sort of sit on the fence and see what's best to be done. In the book, will we have that same kind of respect shown to the Elven King by the Master of Lake Town? Will we get that? will we have a relationship of deference? Will they simply be strangers to each other? The fact that they were both in some way related to Erebor doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be closely related to each other. Of course, the other way in which the elves were very much a factor in the calculations of the mayor of Lake Town and in the lives of the lake men in general is that they have a trade agreement with them. You know, that they have economic advantages from the relationship as well, not merely the fact that the elven king clearly wields a significant amount of military authority in the region. But again, there's the economic factor as well. Those things are foregrounded in Tolkien's discussion of the master's dilemma when Thorin and company come in.
By the way, you slipped just a minute ago and said mayor of Lake Town, which reminded me of something. I was perusing Annotated Hobbit, you know, the margins, reading poems for class, but I also noticed that Doug Anderson brings up in his mind, the similarity between the mayor of Hamelin in the poem Pied Piper and the master of Lake Town, which is kind of interesting because apparently Tolkien hated that story, but I thought, oh, that is interesting, actually. Master of Lake Town really is very much like the mayor of Hamelin. So, anyway, side note.
Yeah, no, mayor, I do sometimes call the master the mayor, and it's a connection which is suggested at a couple points. But but yeah, no, and John Ratliff talks about that connection too with the Pied Piper connection. Though they do it through the Progress in Bimble Bay poem, and I have a hard time getting through that. But anyway, I don't want to enter into a discussion of his poem "Progress in Bimble Bay." But
you expounded a length on that last
Bimble
night.
Town, rather. Yeah. Anyway, So what is the relationship between the land of the elves and the land of the lake? And the other reason that I think that this is a big deal is it will have a lot to do with what's going on at the end in the Battle of Five Armies as a major setup to what we get at the end. Mainly because it's pretty clear in the book. Well, in the book it's complicated because the major kind of grievance, the major discussion point is between Thorin and Bard. They are the two principals in the deliberations that are happening and the discussions that are happening around the Lonely Mountain prior to the outbreak of the Battle of Five Armies. Because Bard is the one who has claims on the treasure through the treasure of Girion, through his killing of the dragon, and it's the men of the lake who helped the dwarves and who are now requesting help in return. As Thorin very rightly points out, he has no reason to think with any kindness upon the Elven King or to do him any favors. So the Elven King is not a principal in the discussions. It's Bard, but he is the one who is sort of primarily supporting Bard. So in the book, we have this situation where Bard is pretty much in command of the expedition up to the Lonely Mountain, and he is certainly the figurehead, since he's the one who has valid claims upon the treasure, and the Elven King has no possible question of any claim upon the treasure. And yet, there's also this sense in which the Elven King is the one kind of propping him up in the first place. I mean, who is this guy? Bard, that is. You know, he has no position even among the men of Lake Town, and the men of Lake Town are a relatively small concern in the larger business of that region. So, whereas the Elven King is a much bigger deal, and we know that at the very least, the Elven King is the big brother of this partnership, you know, of the allegiance that seems to exist. At least, let me say more neutrally, the working arrangement that seems to be in place between Lake Town and Mirkwood in the book. It's as it is clear who's the older sibling in that relationship. But in the movie, how are we going to get this? We've got this conflict between the dwarves and the elves that has already been played up in film one in anticipation of the imprisonment and the unpleasantness to follow in subsequent films. But when they get together, how are they going to set it up so that they get together? I mean, are we going to get a strong lake town in equal alliance with the Elven King so that we have a kind of, you know, joining of two allied, well, okay, not quite superpowers, but, you know, significant powers in the region coming up against Erebor? Or are they going to do it differently? Are we going to see basically a division between Thranduil and Bard, you know, where Thranduil is playing his own game and Bard feels he's being manipulated? Are we going to have the Thranduil actually deferring to Bard in any way? How is that going to be played out? Because so, that's where I feel the initial setup of the political relationship between Lake Town and Mirkwood is really important, because it sets the stage for all of those things, which is going to have a big impact on how the Battle of Five Armies plays out. So what do you think about that question, Dave? What are your let's go ahead and name the terms of Michael's riddle. And then we can do it in terms of the riddle. So okay. So the question of the riddle is just basically directly at what I was just talking about, which is how will the political and economic relationship between Lake Town and Mirkwood be portrayed? And by Mirkwood, of course, we mean Thranduil and the Elven King explicitly. Okay. Option A. They have a trading agreement. Wine or other commodities via barrels, etc., and are political allies. B, they have a trading agreement but aren't allied at all. So there's no real, they're not, they don't consider themselves friends, they just live near each other and sell stuff to each other. C, they're allied but have no trading agreement. So they have friendly connections but don't interact with each other through regular trade. And D, they are not allied and have no trading agreement. So they're just, you know, these two lands are like ships passing in the night. No real connection between them at all prior to the events of the film. Okay, so what do you think?
What do you think, Dave?
Man, I don't know. That's interesting. Which one do we think is the book answer?
Ah, good point. It's either A or B, I think, isn't it?
It's A. I would say that the answer is A. I mean, they're not, like, close allies. They're not, like, really close friends. But they are on good terms, politically speaking. And the Master is wanting to preserve those good terms. And that's why he's finding himself, by harboring and helping Thorin, he could be seen by the Elven King as encouraging one of the enemies of the Elven King, and that would be bad. But again, it's clearly more of a he's afraid of the Elven King more than they are close friends and he doesn't want to disappoint him. But I would actually say that A is closer to the book answer here, because they clearly do have a relationship. That's why when Lake Town is destroyed by the dragon, they send messengers up to ask aid of the Elven King, not as strangers, you know, not as, hey, you may remember us, like, we sell some wine to you and stuff, a dragon just destroyed our town, you know, could you come as strangers and help us? But rather, hi, we're your allies and we need your help, and we'll accept it on any terms. So again, we're not talking about Gondor and Rohan here, but in the book it seems clearly suggested that they are actively allies in some sense.
Now Robert Brown asks, what additional criteria make them allies and not sole trading partners? I think you may have just defined that. You may have just responded to that.
Well, yeah, exactly. A trading agreement would just mean that there is interaction between them at all. I mean, I guess you could say it's a question of like different thresholds of familiarity, right? If they live near each other, but they really have no purposeful interactions with each other of any kind, either political or economic, then, you know, that would be D, none of the above, right? If to have a trade agreement but not a political allegiance would just be, you know, we live nearby, you know, some of your people trade with some of my people. We might make some arrangements for that, but there's no larger partnership between our peoples. Again, we're just still sort of like strangers and people who happen to be near. I mean, to give an example, well, it's kind of a funny example, but I would almost point to the relations between, well, no, because they don't trade at all. It's hard because there are so few other examples of trade. The example I was thinking of that I'm now backing off from is the relationship between the Shire and Bree. They're not allies. You know, they're not connected with each other. They're not kingdoms either. So that is a different situation. But there's no trade relationships between Bree and there is, because Butterbur is familiar with Shire Leaf. He says, you know, he's all for Bree in most matters, but he does agree that the tobacco of the Shire is better. So they must get some leaf out there in Bree.
Mm-hmm.
And when they find the leaf in Isengard, the comment is not, I didn't know this was ever sold, but I didn't know it came so far.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, okay, so there we go. I'm willing to say that Bree and the Shire could be said in some sense to have a trading relationship, but they're not allies. It's not like, our friends and companions in Bree.
So allies would be if Lake Town was filling out a form and it said emergency contact, they would put Mirkwood Elves, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. In case of emergency, notify the Elven King.
Notify the Elven King. Right. Now, right, Brianna makes a good point here. Brianna brings up an interesting point here, and I think I have a slight answer, but I want to see if you can shoot this one down. She says their status as allies probably won't be clarified until film 3, which could make this one a tricky one to judge. Now, I responded by saying, well, I think we may be able to get a sense of if there's an alliance there by the way the Master reacts, which is what you've already talked about.
Yes.
And also, there may be other indications of that. I mean, do you think that's fair, or do you think Brianna makes a point that maybe this isn't a film 2 question?
Well, I mean, I certainly, can I imagine a scenario in which it's not finally resolved until film 3?
Sure.
Sure, but no, for exactly the reason that you said. How much does the Elven King and his reaction factor into the Master's discussion? And you know, his own decision process. If he acts totally independently, I mean, if he doesn't care, I mean, if, you know, if he hear, is he even going to hear that Thorin was imprisoned by the Elven King and escaped? If he does, is he going to care at all? If he does care, then it suggests that there are political relations between them.
Of course, the other reason he might care is just strictly a commercial reason, which is he doesn't want to tick off his major customer. You know what I mean?
Right. And there certainly does seem to be a significant element of that in the book as well.
Right. It's probably where I'm getting it from.
Yeah, exactly.
Gee, here I thought I came up with that all by myself.
Right. No, but I mean, I think that's, yeah, I mean, that is, but see there, it would depend upon how it came across in mm-hmm. the films to be able to try to decide that. Certainly one of the things which demonstrates, I think, most clearly is the fact that they send to them for aid. That suggests pretty, because you don't just do that to your trade partners, you know? You don't.
But like Raina says, that might not happen until the third movie.
Right. No, I agree with that. But I still think there's a lot that the Master of Lake Town could show us that would indicate one way or the other. Not to mention the elves too.
Right, that's true.
Do we ever hear anything about Lake Town from them? Mm-hmm. You know, how are they? How do they talk about it? I mean, in the book, we get contact between, and this is something that I'm not at all sure is going to happen in the film. In the film, you know, when they go down with the barrels. You know, they go down the river in the barrels, and then the barrels are collected and rowed down, you know, pulled down the rest of the river by elves, whose job it is to pull empty barrels down the river. I mean, there's a regular trade route that's maintained by the Elven King, and that's how the Master learns that they were escaped from the Elven King's dungeon, because there are elves there. And this is something that always confuses people, because Tolkien calls them in the book the raftmen of the elves, but he's using the word man generically there. They're elves, they're not humans. But anyway, there are elves present who immediately pipe up and say, hey, these are prisoners of our king. But remember all of that stuff where Bilbo is, we don't get most of the dialogue, but where Bilbo is overhearing the conversation of the raft elves, and by overhearing their talk, learns a lot about Lake Town and the region that they're going into. If we do get that kind of scenario, if the barrels are not just, don't just float down the stream and then, you know, wash up on the shore loose and have Bilbo unlock them, if they do encounter traders like that, you know, that certainly would show us something. I think obviously we're going to get some compression there, but it will be interesting to see, you know, is what we're seeing, basically to put it in a different way, the escape of the dwarves is managed by exploiting what is a standing trading route between the halls of the Elven King and Lake Town in the book. Will that be happening? Will that be what happens in the book? We know they will escape by barrel, but in the book, is it just going to be a matter of finding a bunch of barrels, tossing them in the river, and escaping in them? That is, you know, is it going to be part of the normal trade route or not? Oh, I could easily imagine, for instance, Bilbo arranging, like, to let loose a bunch of barrels, not in the way that they're normally supposed to go, like how the elves roll the barrels in and then release them from the water gate and everything else, but rather there just being a bunch of barrels which happen to be near the water, and Bilbo contriving to get the barrels accidentally rolled into the river and then have them float away, and have the elves be standing there saying, crap, there go a bunch of our barrels. you know, and then down they go down the river and let them out by Lake Town.
I think we've seen a clip with somebody, and I want to say it was Bilbo. Brandon might remember this, where he's actually pulling a lever, which seemed to be like releasing barrels. And maybe I dreamed it. I don't know. Well, Brianna, you can remind me if this is actually the case.
I would kind of expect that. I would kind of expect that.
Okay.
Bilbo to be more active in that. But that doesn't necessarily, I mean, but again, that still leaves open the question, is this an established trade route, the barrel route? Is the barrel route an established trade route between the lake and the forest? And it's not obvious to me that they will have to do it that way. It may well be that no question of trade is ever really brought up in the film as that kind of element of local economics does not always make for the most gripping movie material, strangely. So maybe there will be no reference to trade whatsoever.
That's true. Well, I'm going to step back.
Is anyone
out and
ready
go for
to
the
make
answer.
A prediction?
I'm going to go for A.
I don't know. Dave, you've been kind of quiet, so I'm going to put you on the spot. What do you think?
It's my problem is I have trouble mentally getting purchase on what anything but A would look like. I don't see a compelling reason to do anything significantly different from the book, and that I feel like if they do anything, if they change it at all, they'll make it even stronger. They might make the alliance even stronger. I don't know. Maybe they're estranged at this point. I guess you could make an argument for that. And I feel like it's possible that maybe they'll weaken the trading agreement in the sense that, like, or at least there won't be any evidence on screen of any kind of strong trading agreement. I could see them doing, like, you know, especially with the little shot of Bilbo pulling a lever and dumping barrels in the water, that maybe the elves aren't in the habit of sending barrels down the river to Lake Town, and maybe Bilbo just kind of, you know, just grabs some barrels and throws them in the river type thing, and the elves are like, ah, oh, like you said, oh crap, there goes some of our right. barrels. Well, you gonna go get them, Frank? Nah, right. we'll just write them off of our taxes, lost capital equipment or
right.
something.
Right, exactly.
So I guess I could see them doing that, and then the Alliance. Maybe there's a possibility of them. Like, maybe that's one of the things from history that we'll see, that, like, oh, they used to be all allied and friends back in the days of the Lonely Mountain, but now they're estranged, and, you know, there's just, like, this black market barrel trade, but that's it. But I don't find any of that compelling. Like, I still, at the end of the day, I'm like, it's probably...
Black market trade in butter and apples up and down the river.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, here's one idea, Dave, as to what it can look like. One possibility of a non-allied situation would be the human settlement on the lake is below the notice of the elves. Like, they don't care about it at all. They don't pay a lick of attention to it. Maybe there are some elves who trade some stuff with the humans, and so there are a few of the elves, like the wine traders and stuff, who notice that there are humans there, and maybe if it ever comes to the attention of the Elven King that there is a town full of human beings living on the lake, he only cares in so much as he knows they have vineyards and send him and they buy wine from them, but other than that, they don't factor into his political thing at all. And to him, this is just about to the Elven King, this is just about him and Thorin. Mm-hmm. And then the fall of the dragon at the hands of this insignificant, you know, one of the people in this insignificant settlement of human beings, then creates a situation where Thranduil says, okay, now I can capitalize on this. You know, now I will come to them and be like, ah, let us be allies, me and your, you know, not so mighty kingdom, but whatever. I will treat you as if you were an ally, so I can use you as a cat's paw in my ongoing conflict with Thorin. That would be one way in which we have no real, you know. And so depending on how you do the wine trading element in there, they could have some relationship with them. They could have no connection with them. But I could definitely see them choosing, and you could say that this was set up in the prologue by the fact that we get the fealty of Thranduil, but no reference to the humans at all, that to Thranduil, the humans aren't even in this equation. And he doesn't really care. So that's one, just I'm trying to be helpful, Dave, to assist in what that, in envisioning what that might look like.
Right. But you're not actually convinced by any of those things.
I don't know. I think I need to talk about it a little bit more to convince myself, I think.
Yeah. I'm leaning toward A. I think that's what I'm going to go with.
Here is the one thing in what I just said that I do find most convincing, though. I do suspect that to Thranduil, the situation is primarily going to be about him and Thorin. I'm not really sure that he's going to see the whole Siege of the Lonely Mountain as a genuine three-body equation. Bard is going to be a factor because he killed the dragon. Mm-hmm. But Bard could easily just be, certainly in the eyes of the Elven King, merely a cat's paw. It's not being a question of, we are here to support our friends, the Men of the Lake. You know, this is really a Men of the Lake issue, and we're just here because we're their allies, and we're helping them, which is the Elven King's line in the book. But I could easily see film Thranduil not going in that direction at all. And I expect Thranduil to be pretty unpleasant, actually. So I could see him But then you get the Master of Lake Town figure, who is himself, you know, cunning and manipulative and trying to manipulate things for his own personal best, first and foremost, and for the profit of Lake Town secondarily. It's just, of course, I'm trying to decide whether I can really talk myself into it. Because I think if I didn't go with A, where I would go would be D. That is, the elves just not paying a lick of attention to the human beings.
So it's all or nothing. They're either allied and trading, or they don't even realize they exist.
Yeah, well, they might realize they exist, just not care. Just have them not be a factor at all in their lives. That's what I'm debating. The extremes are definitely the most attractive to me. I don't know. This is a tough one. I mean, I guess I could imagine a middle ground. But I don't think they're going to be allies. I don't.
Really?
I don't think we're going to have a pre-existing friendship. Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. Mostly because I think the humans are going to be too small potatoes, and I think that the kingdom of the elves is going to be built up as a great thing, bigger than it is in the book. And in the book, it's significantly bigger than Lake Town. And I think that what we're going to get in the Master is basically a conniving politician on the make who is trying to make something out of nothing, who knows that what he's doing is being the, you know, like petty dictator of a small time establishment, but that he's going to be trying to do everything that he can to expand, you know, Lake Town's holdings and Lake Town's position. So I expect to see both before and after the death of the dragon, a lot of positioning on the part of the mayor of Lake Town. I expect, by the way, Stephen Fry to be involved at the Lonely Mountain. That's a free prediction. You know how in the book the Master of Lake Town gets left behind, and it's just Bard and the Elven King up there? No way, man. I think unless they kill off Stephen Fry in the battle, which is conceivable, but I don't look for it, then I think that the Master of Lake Town is going to be involved, and we're going to get, like, you know, backdoor stuff between the Elven King and the Master behind Bard's back, and like the Master is going to be, on the one hand, like facilitating and claiming to be, you know, helping Bard, but like he's going to be totally stabbing Bard in the back and trying to arrange other deals. And I think there's a lot of potential for the Master here, and that's what I do expect the Master to be much more. But he disappears after that scene where Bard crawls out of the water. And everybody tries to acclaim him king, and the Master does his, like, manipulative political thing. From that moment on, the Master almost completely vanishes from the story until we hear about
it. And we get him as an epilogue. Yeah, we get him as an epilogue kind of later.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen.
What about the...
Well, especially with Stephen Fry. I mean, he's a big draw, so...
Right.
And what about the possibility of them being... hostile. Somebody proposed that idea in here. Robert Brown, could they be hostile and racing each other to the mountain?
No, I don't see that, mostly because, I mean, the humans aren't going to be in a position to race, and I think it's much more likely that the Elven King is going to see them as a tool that can be used, because again, they have a claim. Right? So when it's just, you know, the first impulse of the Elven King in the book, the first impulse of the Elven King is to race everybody else to the mountain, right? Smaug is dead. All right. I'm like getting on my horse and I'm taking my army and we're going to the mountain as fast as possible to like plant our little flag on that little mountain of treasure. Absolutely.
Oh, that's right, because they assume the dwarves are dead, don't they?
Yeah, initially. Exactly. Yeah. They assume the dwarves are dead. Then when it turns out that, oh, unfortunately, Thorin isn't dead, and there's actually a king of the dwarves, sort of, after a fashion, to negotiate with, kind of, then I guess we have to do that. So once he's in that position of negotiating, then I would expect him to say, okay, oh, yes, no, Bard, absolutely, yeah. No, he's the Dragon Slayer. He totally, yeah, it's his claims I'm here supporting. And then have the master be like, yeah, okay, you and I know how we can both make out of this. And I think those kinds of situations are going to arise to complicate things around the Loneliness.
So did you say you're going with, what was it you said you're going with, D? Or B?
Well, no, D is what I said. And now I'm just thinking briefly about the trade stuff. Do I really insist on there having no trade?
See, I think it could, I think a trade agreement for sure. Because, I mean, from what you were saying earlier, it made me think of it like an aristocratic's view of a tradesman. You know, sort of a necessary evil,
right.
But they're a they supply us. So,
right.
You know, I let them in the back door. They have to only they can only come to the tradesman entrance kind of thing.
Right,
but still,
exactly.
There's a trading agreement.
Exactly, yeah. No, and I'm thinking about that more and more. I'm thinking, because with the barrels, I think that's likely to come about. And it would, that's actually more appealing, more than like, wait, there are humans who live over there? To have the reaction be, what, the serfs? Oh, should I pay attention to them? Oh, the wine growers? Oh, yes, they're handy, but who cares? Yeah, no, absolutely. Let me look down my long, delicate elven nose out from under my... unexpectedly bushy elven eyebrows at the human, you know, the blue collar humans who live over there and now pretend to take them seriously. That appeals much more. So yeah, no, okay, I'm gonna go with B then. I have crafted.
So you go with B, okay.
I'm gonna go with B. I have crafted my rationale.
Your justification.
I'm sticking with it. Yep.
I'm going with A. You guys have worn me out. I'm going to go with the book answer.
All right. Well, I think, Trish, I think we have to let you go, too, so we should probably...
Yes, well, I wanted to wind up with this Tauriel thing, because Michael Lucera shared, and I'll share this URL when I do the post, and I'll try to get it up sooner. There's an article in... EW.com, entertainmentweekly.com. It's a first look at Evangeline Lilly's Elf Warrior. And she, it says here, Tauriel isn't only a fierce warrior. She has a softer side, too. Lilly says she will definitely have a love story. I can't give away too much about it. It's not a huge focus, but it is there, and it is important, and it does drive Tauriel and her story and her actions. Will that romance involve Orlando Bloom's Legolas by any chance? Lily won't say definitively one way or the other, but she does offer this much. Tauriel's relationship with Legolas is significant. They've known each other since they were children, and Legolas's dad, Elven King Thranduil, has a soft spot for Tauriel and sees something very special in her. So if you grow up side by side and your dad has a very special spot in his heart for this young woman who's a fantastic warrior, I think it's hard not to notice her.
Well, that's boring.
So predictable.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll post. There's more in the article, but I'll just post it on the site.
Yeah.
Actually, Michael Lucero posted it up on the Tolkien Professor Facebook page. So if you want to go see it, it's there.
Yeah. As kind of like disturbing as the whole Kiwi Tauriel concept was when we first heard about that, it's much more interesting than guess what? She's in love with Legolas.
Okay. I know.
Or Legolas.
But now Legolas is in love with her, and I think Brianna's right. I think Laura and I are going to have to go back and, you know, make that conundrum go both ways.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But yeah. Anyway, it is kind of boring, isn't it?
It would be. That would be. If it were just about her and Legolas, that would be kind of boring. I have to admit I'd be disappointed. But then again, what would be the alternative? Given, as I said, it's really hard to imagine, you know, one of the only female characters in the whole cast of men
right.
and have no romantic angle whatsoever. What are the other options? I mean, you've got Kiwi, who is obviously your leading possibility among the dwarves, and you've got Legolas. Who else is there? I mean, like, what, Gandalf?
Plus...
Radagast? Sebastian? Who else is going to be a candidate?
Right.
Yeah.
The Witch King? I mean, really.
Right.
But also, isn't it too tempting? I mean, you know, having Legolas be smitten and then have her buy the farm at the Battle of Five Armies. I mean, you've got this tragic love story, which also then explains why he's so single in Lord of the Rings. That's, I mean, I thought about that when I first heard about her. I thought, oh, it's going to be a thing with Legolas. She's going to die at the Battle of Five Armies. Very tragic, sad, sad.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I mean, and that could be, I mean, I don't want to be too dismissive. You know, I say it's boring. In concept, it's boring. In execution, it might be very moving and everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not, but I mean, you know, I will actually.
Of course, you know, we have problems with the innovations too, like the bunny sled.
Exactly. And also, apart from the fact that it seems kind of hypocritical simultaneously to complain about everything that they change and to complain about everything that's predictable. But nevertheless, it's one of my frequent sayings about books in general. I think that people value surprise too much. Surprise is a cheap thrill. Doing something well and satisfyingly, which is foreseen and anticipated, is actually, I think, far more powerful than, you know, the little shock and thrill that comes when something unexpected happens. Lots of people are reeling from the ice. I have not been keeping up with the Game of Thrones miniseries, but I have been seeing in the news that the Red Wedding has finally happened. I have read
and
the
Dave
book.
Dave was fairly outspoken in a Facebook post the other day,
yeah,
I noticed.
Yeah. But anyway,
surprisingly.
The Red Wedding was effective in the books, not because it was unexpected. I saw it coming up for hundreds of pages. But I was like moving, I kept rolling through that book towards it with this, like this growing sense of dread, and when it happened, it was just as awful. Okay, no, it was actually slightly even more awful than I expected. But anyway, it's not. So it wasn't like the effect of that was not generated by shock and surprise and it's being unexpected. It was, you know, the long-awaited unveiling of this thing that you have been anticipating and seeing coming, and it was very effectively done, better than surprise, I thought. So. But anyway, I probably should.
Oh, I just had a really something that James Pace put up here about a love triangle. I just had a really horrible thought. What if there's like a Arthur Guinevere Lancelot kind of thing going on with Legolas and Thranduil and Tariel? No, forget it. I'm going to edit this part out.
Ooh,
I didn't even say that.
Golly, yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be incestuous.
Right, no, yeah,
I
but
mean,
it's,
it would be.
But, right,
but still, but, between it would be, you know, father son
rivalry between like sexual rivalry between father and son.
Yeah,
or
I just no, I don't
it's
want
a little,
that.
It does kind of make you want to bathe afterwards just a little bit.
That is kind of that's a little too Games of Thrones-y, isn't it?
Well, it's a little too, yeah, I don't know. I kind of hope not.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know, we'll see.
I have my car keys in my hand, and I need to.
We should let you go. Thanks to everybody for joining us. And again, echoing Dave's apologies at the beginning, thank you for being patient with us. I do hope we are able to be a little bit more dependable from here on out, certainly.
We have the intention of getting better. No promises, but we're intending to get better.
Yeah, so we will hope not to change things too many times for next time.
And Robert Brown wants to know, when's the Fall of Arthur seminar?
There are a couple things that I'm thinking about doing with that, actually. I'd like to do something in the short term that would require less planning, and then maybe do something more like a more formal read-through and discussion later on. But I was actually
thinking... That would be fun to have kind of an informal Q&A kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of doing something maybe over Twitter, because I haven't read it yet. I've been so busy with real estate and stuff that I've been saving it. I haven't actually sat down and read The Fall of Arthur because I didn't want to squeeze it into odd minutes while I was doing other things. I want to savor it. So I haven't read it yet, actually. And
or do you think you could do a like the Skype things you used to do way back in the old days?
I might do that. I might also, but I was actually kind of thinking of like live tweeting The Fall of Arthur and inviting like Twitter discussion and Q&A at particular points, like about particular parts of the story, and then we could follow it up later on with a more of a class thing. Maybe I'll intersperse Q&A stuff with that. So, you know, that kind of informal thing I'm sort of thinking. And then we'll do, well, of course, the real thing, Verlyn Flieger is teaching her class at Midgard in the fall, in which she's doing the Fall of Arthur, and she's the real expert on the Fall of Arthur. So I might be an enthusiast, but she is the genuine expert. So that, of course, will be the real Fall of Arthur class. But yeah, no, we will definitely do some stuff, and it will happen relatively soon, I think.
Cool. Cool, all right. Cool.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us. So thanks for listening, and Godspeed.